The Laura Murphy Show, episode 45.
Welcome to The Laura Murphy Show, the podcast that analyzes financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept. Listen and learn as your hosts, Robert Murphy and Carlos Lara, explain how you can be part of building the 10%.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Did you miss us? We're busy guys. We had stuff going on, but we're back here for you. Today, we're going to be talking about tax reform and tax cutting, or the lack thereof for many segments of the population. With me, as always, is Carlos Lara. Carlos, how are things in Nashville?
They're very good, Bob. It was good to see you in New Jersey a couple of weeks ago. Like I said, I miss you since you've moved to Texas. So every chance I get a chance to visit live, it's fun.
Well, I miss you too, you know, but this is a heartfelt reunion, folks, but we got to stick to the material today. We could just go on and on reminiscing about glories of the past, but what's important is the future, and how is the GOP tax plan going to affect you and the country as a whole? That's what we're talking about today. So I think, let me first give just a very quick review foundation, if you will, about the logic from a standard economics perspective of tax reform. All right, so this is a distinction you'll hear in this discussion. I've even seen some right-leaning economists saying things like, what the country really needs is tax reform, not a tax cut. So let me just explain what that means. So it's typical when you're thinking about taxes to just imagine, oh, how much money is the government taking from me or taking from the taxpayers? And that's fine, especially if you're coming from like a Rothbardian perspective and you think that, you know, everything should be voluntary. Yeah, the fact that someone's taking more money from you, that's a bad thing. And I can understand that. But in terms of standard economic analysis, the kind you would get in a, you know, regular university, there's a whole logic of efficiency when it comes to taxation. And let me be clear, efficiency in this context doesn't mean goodness. Okay, so to say, oh, it's more efficient to raise $1 trillion of tax revenue through this kind of a tax versus this other kind of a tax, I'm not saying, therefore, I, Bob Murphy, prefer the, quote, more efficient one. I'm just telling you what the standard economics is in the sense in which that term efficiency is being used. All right. So it's not arbitrary. There is a logic behind it. But again, I just want to be clear at the outset, efficiency is not the same thing as moral goodness. Okay. With all those disclaimers, let me just quickly summarize the point I'm trying to get across here. So if the government has to raise a certain amount of revenue or desires to raise a certain amount of revenue, standard economics says there's ways of doing it that will distort the economy more or less. So for example, if you're going to raise $1 trillion and, you know, there's three different options, let's say. One is you could levy a tax on income. And so, you know, economists could sit there and run the numbers and say, all right, given what the parameters are in the economy and so forth, this is, if we're just going to tax income broadly speaking, then this is what the tax rate would have to be so that when the dust settles, the government ends up collecting $1 trillion in revenue. Okay, that's one approach. Another approach would be to levy a tax on consumption, let's say. All right, and so there, you know, there's different ways you could do it. A way that's done in practice is this, it's like an income tax, but anything you save then gets deducted. So you're only taxed on that portion of your income that you consume. All right, so that's a way of doing it. Or you could do something like a head tax, right? That just says, how much money do we need? Let's divide up by the number of people in the country and then say everybody owes, you know, $1 trillion divided by 300 million or whatever the population is. And everybody's responsible. And, you know, a little kid or something, then the parent's responsible for paying the kid's portion of the head tax, right? So those are different ways of raising $1 trillion, let's say. And so then if you ask standard economists, somebody like Greg Mankiw or something, hey, given that the government is going to wring $1 trillion per year out of the population, do you have any insight or any guidance as a standard mainstream economist as to the ways of doing it? Between those three things that I've just chosen, I think that, you know, part of the explanation would run like this and say, okay, if we do it as a income versus consumption, they would say we have a preference to do it, levying it on consumption. And here's why. If you levy it on consumption, that's going to distort things, right? What specifically what's going to happen is people aren't going to have the incentive to work as much, to use, you know, their resources, including their labor skills, to earn income as much as they otherwise would have, because the whole point of doing that is to then go buy things and consume. And so if the government's levying a percentage tax on consumption, on the margin, that's making your leisure more attractive. Or even like if you own woods or something somewhere and you're considering a shopping mall developer comes along and says, hey, you know, you've got this nice, these woodlands here, looks very pretty, but I'll pay you a bunch of money in order to clear cut this thing and put up a shopping mall. And so you're weighing the pros and cons of that. If, you know, part of the benefit to you of clearing it, the land, and getting the big lump sum paycheck is then you're going to go out and consume. You're going to buy sports cars and fancy clothes and take trips and what have you. And so if now the government is levying a percentage tax on that because it's consumption, then that's going to make you more likely to not develop the land, right? Because you're not getting taxed just owning this raw land that's sitting there. It's nice to look at, and, you know, there's squirrels bouncing around or whatever, and you like that. Okay, so that's the problem from a consumption tax, is that it makes people less willing to develop their resources and sell them against money in the marketplace and then go buy things with it, because the government is, you know, in a sense, arbitrarily reducing your earning power in terms of what you can do with that, with those financial earnings. But an income tax is worse in that respect. An income tax distorts things even more, because not only does the income tax penalize you for working and earning income, but it also penalizes you for saving. And the reason is that if an income tax is broadly defined, well, and, you know, standard accounting, and this is correct, if you earn, let's say, $100,000 in your labor income, and then you consume $80,000 of it, and then you save $20,000. Well, the $20,000 now generates you either dividend or interest income or capital gains. It depends on how you invest the thing. But, you know, the benefit to you from saving and investing is that you will, that will throw off more income. So down the road, it's not just your labor power that's bringing in wage income, but also your investments, you know, your assets, your financial assets are generating income of some form. Again, depending on what you put it in, it'd either be classified as dividends, interest, or a capital gain. But either way, that's extra income flowing in, right? That's the benefit to you. That's why you might save and invest. Okay, but now that is also falling under the definition of income. And so for standard definitions of an income tax, that stuff is also going to get taxed, perhaps at a lower rate, but nonetheless is going to be taxed as income. And so if you see, that's like a double whammy. That if the government's going to try to raise $1 trillion a year by taxing income, that's messing up two decisions. Number one, it's messing up how much you want to sell your labor power or your other assets like land resources and what have you for money, as opposed to just leaving them idle. In the case of labor, that means, you know, you're enjoying your leisure. But so that's what a consumption tax screws up. But an income tax screws that decision up. And on top of that, given however much your income is this period, an income tax stacks the deck against you saving it, because if you save it, then you generate more income next period. So an income tax, like if it's 30% or something, means you only get to keep 70% of that future income that your savings decision would yield you. So again, the income tax, again, this is standard analysis. Economists would say the problem with an income tax, why it's more inefficient, why it screws up decisions more than just a standard consumption tax, is that it messes up your decision on two different margins, that how much do you want to convert your assets into money? And then for any amount of money you're earning this period, how much of it do you want to save? And income tax screws that up. Okay, and just to complete the train of thought, a head tax doesn't suffer from that, either of those things, right? If it's just saying the government just says to everybody, hey, you owe whatever, $2,000 per year. We don't care what you do. We don't care how much income you earn. We don't, you know, but you just owe us $2,000, period. Then that doesn't screw up any of those other economic decisions, right? You don't have a penalty on earning more income. It's not that you owe more tax if you earn more income. So that's not changing that decision. and it's not messing up your, you know, how much do you want to save or not? Okay. Cause again, it's just no matter what you do every year, you owe whatever it is, $2,000 period. Okay. So now there's other issues going on, right? There's issues of fairness, ability to pay, and so on. So I'm not saying this is the sole criterion by which we should decide. And of course, I'm against taxation, period. I'm a Rothbardian, but I just want to get people to see the logic of it, that there's a sense in which something like a head tax does not distort economic decisions as much. Okay, so having gone through all that, so you see the distinction there. We're not talking about a tax cut there. We were just saying, given what the target amount of revenue is, what method is the government going to use to calculate and allocate the tax burden, keeping in mind that's going to set up incentives and make people behave differently. And so what economists mean by deadweight loss, if you've heard that term, it's saying like, if people act in a way and respond to the tax code such that mutually advantageous trades are not happening, then that doesn't help anybody. Okay. So if the government, just to give an extreme example, if the government said, oh, we're going to tax income at 100%, then nobody on paper would earn income, right? There'd be black market activity. People wouldn't just literally stop working, but they would do stuff and not report it. And so the point is the government wouldn't be getting any revenue in that scenario. And yet the economy would be totally screwed up if there was this official 100% tax rate that forced everybody to do everything in the black market. And so that would clearly screw things up. And yet there wouldn't be any corresponding gain to the treasury because of that. And so you can see that's, you know, I'm just exaggerating, but clearly you can see there that would be silly. You know, people would say, whoa, we can make a change to the tax code that's going to bring in more revenue and make people be happier. You know, that they can get more out of the economy, even though they're sending bigger checks to the government. Okay, so that's the distinction between just cutting taxes per se, like leaving more resources in the hands of the private sector, and tax reform. And so when it comes to the convoluted, crazy tax code, the theory is, the logic behind it is to say, oh, why don't we get rid of these deductions and exemptions and blah, 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 and lower the rates so that even if on paper we were bringing the same amount, now businesses, it's a much more simpler operation. You don't have to go pay thousands of dollars to your CPA or tax attorney to sit there and give you advice and calculate how much you owe and all that kind of stuff. That, you know, you don't want the whole economy operating in a large fashion just because of what the tax code is. You want the economy doing what makes economic sense, and then the government skimming off money from the top in, as you know, a way that distorts things as little as possible. That's the theory behind tax reform. So with this Republican thing, and don't worry, Carlson, I'm getting ready to stop and I'll turn it over to you. But with this Republican thing, the deal is they're going to give a net tax cut, the way they calculate these things, of about $1.5 trillion over the first 10 years. And there's political reasons for that, that if they keep it to $1.5 trillion, the Democrats can't filibuster it. That's my understanding of the way the rules are right now. So that's where that magic number is coming from. But then on top of that, they're arguing, hey, it's not just that we're giving money back to the taxpayers, but we're also changing the code to make it more pro-growth or supply side, to give incentives. And that's in particular how they're arguing for the corporate income tax rate reduction from 35 down to 20%. The argument is, this isn't just a giveaway to rich shareholders. This will cause businesses, corporations to want to invest more because now we're lowering the penalty on future income. So now on the margin, they're going to want to invest more. That will lead to more capital formation. And so workers will have more tools and equipment. Their productivity will be higher. They'll get paid higher wages, right? So that's the logic for people saying this thing, even though a lot of the on paper tax cuts accrue to the wealthy, even average blue collar workers will in the long run benefit because there's going to be a bigger capital stock from this thing. Okay. So I threw out a lot of stuff there. Carlos, why don't you come in and set people straight and, you know, get away from my ivory tower stuff. Again, last caveat, folks, I'm not endorsing every last jot and tittle of what I just said, but I just want to, you know, lay the table or set the table for when you go to read other discussions of this stuff. That's kind of the mindset that a lot of these economists are going to have.
All right. Well, I'd like to see if I can present this thing from the perspective of a business owner, which is what I am, someone that owns several businesses. I'm also very conscious of the fact that I pay, you know, taxes as an individual. And there's always a concern as how is all this going to affect me? And as we approach this tax reform act that the GOP is attempting to push through, I do want to make sure that the audience that's listening right now realizes that everybody and his uncle is writing about this thing. And from what I can tell, those are the folks that are talking about this tax reform. They're saying a lot of things about it. They're writing a lot of things. And it can get quite confusing over some of the things that they're writing and talking about. I wondered how many people are actually even aware of all of the minutiae that they're dealing with. And they're just, when it finally comes into law, it's at that point that people start to realize what has actually happened. Now, I'm very biased over this kind of a plan. The last one we had like this was in 1986, and you've heard me say this before, that particular tax act at that time caused some very serious problems in the economy, some of the worst that we've ever had. So
yeah, let me just stop you there for a second. So just to tie this, so folks listening, this is interesting because Carlos is kind of flipping it. You'll hear the Republicans who are all for this thing are saying, oh, this is the most comprehensive tax reform we've had in 30 years. So yes, they're all alluding to the 1986 Tax Reform Act, which in, you know, Ronald Reagan lore has gone down as, wow, that was a great achievement of the Reagan administration. They simplified the tax code. They, you know, lowered the rates. They got rid of some of the brackets. They consolidated. They got rid of loopholes, made the tax code simpler, more efficient. Wow, great job, Gipper. And so Carlos has been maintaining that, hey, there was a lot that went wrong with that and it screwed things up. So I just wanted to jump in there, Carlos, and make sure people saw the importance of what you're saying here.
Well, as I said, you know, I actually got hurt as a business owner when that occurred, and so did a lot of business owners. Now, there was some good things about that. You know, a lot of people forget that in the late 60s and 1970s, we were in a very high tax bracket era. I mean, the income tax was at 70%. And the capital gains tax was at 30% during this period of time. So when Ronald Reagan did come into office, you know, his basic thrust was that if we could let the people keep a lot more of their money, that they would be able to reinvest some of that money back into the economy. So his whole plan was to lower the existing tax rates. And of course, he did do that. He brought it down from the levels where they were down to some very low levels. I think the individual rate came down to 25%, and the capital gains tax went from 30% down to 20%. So he did lower taxes. Now, of course, as we all know, the taxes went back up again. It's important to realize that one of the key selling tools to that Ronald Reagan Tax Reform Act was brought about by Arthur Laffer with his Laffer curve. And I remember looking into that particular curve and studying it very closely, and there were some good points to be made there, Bob. And I know you had an association with Laffer when you came to Nashville, but he made some good points because he was emphasizing that if you cut taxes on people, on businesses and on individuals, they would be able to take and have more money for themselves, but they would reinvest that money back into the economy. And so the economy would grow. And the Treasury would actually wind up with more taxes. And I saw how his curve worked. And Laffer kept insisting that there was a fine line there on how much to cut or how much to increase. And he kept saying, if you increase taxes on people too much, eventually the people will lose their incentive to work. So the idea is cut their taxes, you get more productivity in the economy, and the economy will grow. So the Treasury actually winds up with more tax revenue. Now, as I look at this GOP tax plan, this is what I see them saying. In effect, if ever the GOP is going to be able to get some kind of a major plan across, it's going to be right now because they control the House and the Senate. They control more of the House than they do the Senate. I think they only have like two extra seats in the Senate. Now, the thing to realize, so if they're going to be able to put something through, it's this time around, and this would probably be a big boost to Donald Trump. But I think Donald Trump's whole basis for this Tax Reform Act is to do something very similar to what Ronald Reagan did. He is saying cut taxes on the individual and the corporations. And yes, I know that this on the front end is going to cost us probably about $1.4 trillion. And so that we're going to have to run deficit spending for a while. But folks, I guarantee you that this is going to be made up by the growth in the economy. Now, I think this is the emphasis that I'm hearing coming from the GOP, that this is the reason for this whole tax plan. There's a lot of political stuff going on there, but I think this is how they're trying to get it across. Now, right now, as we're speaking, it's not law, and they're still arguing over it. And one of the things we need to realize is that some of the changes, well, they cover all kinds of changes for individuals. It'll affect some individuals and won't affect other individuals. But the House and the Senate right now do not agree on each one of the points that they're trying to overhaul. So they've got a ways to go. They've got to come together before it becomes law. And so as we're speaking about these individual things, we got to realize that it's not law yet, but this is some of the things that they're trying to push through, some of the things they're arguing about.
Yeah. Thanks for that, Carlos. Just a minor clarification. I just looked it up to be sure. I think what they brought the top rate down to 28% in the 80s.
That's correct. It was 28%.
Yeah. But, and it is kind of amazing. So, folks, if you want to see more on this, I'm going to be writing on it for sure. This issue of the Laura Murphy Report. Carlos may come to this, whether this month or later. But it is amazing just to see, like, you know, we're cynical and we poo-poo stuff. And as Carlos has mentioned, the 86 Tax Reform Act took away a lot of the, quote, loopholes for real estate tax shelters. And that caused the real estate market to crash. But nonetheless, you can kind of see, I mean, it really was amazing. If you look at the state of the tax code in terms of the income tax code with, you know, the brackets and the rates as of 1980, and then you look at what it ended up under 88, it is amazing. Like, they brought it down to just the two brackets with 15% and 28%, whereas before there were lots of brackets, the top one being 70%. So you can see why, you know, there is some justification for people looking back fondly on that. And so the contrast between the amazing reforms of that era versus the little piddly things they're proposing now is kind of disheartening. Let me also mention, I'm looking right now at the Senate version. So as Carlos has said, that, you know, there's a House version and a Senate version. They have to reconcile them and then, you know, try to come up with something that the Congress agrees on and then gives it to Trump to see if he'll pass sign it into law. But you got to be careful. This is very slippery. I haven't seen anyone else mentioning this. So this is a scoop coming from Bob Murphy, folks. But so the standard shtick that you'll hear from the GOP defenders of this thing, or the actual Congress people, I've heard them on NPR or whatever, people will say stuff like, wait a minute, you're taking away deductions? You're going to limit like how much a homeowner can deduct from his mortgage interest, and people in, you know, in high tax states, you're going to take away the deductibility of state and local taxes. And then what the standard response is to say, well, yeah, we are taking away deductions, but we're lowering rates across the board. And so you need to take that into account. And, you know, it's going to promote simplicity and you know, that's the thing. What's funny, though, is that at least the Senate version, they're not merely lowering the rates. They're also changing the thresholds at which those brackets kick in. And so depending on your income, you actually might see your rates go up, let alone if you lose deductions. So let me just give you two quick examples, folks, here. If you earn $170,000, under current law, your marginal tax rate is 28%. In contrast, under the Senate bill, the original one that they were batting around, your rate would have gone up to 32.5%, and the what's called the chairman's mark would have been 32%. Okay, so even if it's the chairman's mark, which is better for you, that's still a 4 percentage point increase in the rate that's applied, you know, to your the top level of your income taxes there. So that's, again, like I said, if you lived in California, New York or something, you're also going to lose the deductibility that you currently have on your state and local taxes. So you're getting a double whammy. Your rate for at least that portion of your income that's in the top bracket or your top bracket is going up, and you're losing some deductions that presumably are quite valuable to you. Another example, somebody who makes $200,000. Under current law, the marginal rate that applies to your income is 33%. Under the Senate version, the chairman's markup, it would go up to 35%. Okay, so again, the rate that's applied to your income at the top levels for you is going to jump by 2 percentage points. So this is very sneaky where, and you wouldn't notice this if you just look at the thing, and like I say, I'll cover this more in this issue of the Laura Murphy Report coming out in November of 2017 for people who are hearing this later. If you just look at the list of the brackets, it looks like everybody either is having the same or is getting a small rate reduction. But again, you got to look more carefully at the thresholds and you realize that they are, yeah, the rate for each bracket either stays the same or goes down a little bit. But the income you need to earn in order to get into that bracket is also being reduced.
Yeah.
And so there's plenty of people where your actual, the rate applied to your income at the top level of your range is going to go up, even though you wouldn't realize that just looking at the thing quickly. So it's a little bit slippery, and I just want to make sure people are aware of that. Like, I had just assumed, because I don't have many deduction, I live in Texas, I had just assumed that I was going to get a quote net tax cut. And then I was looking carefully at these things and I was like, wait a minute, actually, depending on how this thing shakes out with the Senate versus the House version, my actual marginal tax rate might go up depending on where the thresholds fall. So not that it's all about me, folks, but I'm just saying you should look at this thing and realize it's not even what it purports to be of a general tax rate reduction for everybody. No, for some people, the rate might go up for you.
Yeah, Bob, if I can just reinterpret that in different words to make sure we stay in line with what we just said here, that the House has one version and the Senate has another version, okay? And they haven't agreed as to which version yet. Now, let's all remember that we have right now in current law seven tax brackets. And the Senate version wants to keep those same seven tax brackets, but they're saying that they want to lower the rates for most of the brackets. But as Bob has said, there's also increases there. And the thing to realize about the Senate version is that the rate cuts would only sunset until 2026. So see, they've got these nuances in there. Whereas the House version, they want to do away with the seven brackets that we currently have and reduce it down to just four. So if you remember, in the seven brackets, we start off with the 10% bracket. Well, the House bracket now starts with 12%. You see, so they've reducing it down to four brackets instead of the seven. So there's differences in what the House has agreed to up until November 16th, which is just the other day, and what the Senate, you know, has agreed to up to the same date. And so I am saying again that they don't agree on what it should be. And before it becomes law, somehow or another, we're going to wind up either with seven brackets or four brackets, and I don't know which one it's going to be.
Yeah. So, Carlos, maybe we could, you know, we sort of summarize the theory and some of the specifics of this thing. But I'm curious, can you talk a little bit, you know, not only are you a business owner yourself, but your job, if you will, the last several decades is you've been consulting and working with business owners, helping them develop strategies and so on. Can you speak to, you know, in your experience, and as we were saying before the podcast here, I don't have a dog in this fight. I'm just curious what your honest answer is. Is it true? Like, do you think business owners respond to marginal tax rates that much? Like, is it the kind, you know, case where they might work more hours or they might start some, you know, new investment, open up a new storefront or what have you, if, you know, if the corporate income tax rate's 20 instead of 35. The other thing too, by the way, folks, is I don't have the specifics at my fingertips, but there are things in here, I believe, about, well, gee, you know, there's plenty of business owners who have pass through income, like S Corps or whatever. So they're going to like try to cap how much the rates there are. Because so it's not just people benefiting from the corporate income tax rate reduction, but also worrying about, let's try to give tax relief to other business owners who report differently. So in general, Carlos, I'm just curious your thoughts is, you know, how much does the kind of person that in the rhetoric, at least, is the beneficiary of this plan and the guy who goes out and creates a bunch of jobs by, you know, having a medium sized business, in your view, like, do tax rates matter all that much?
Bob, I would say that they do matter from a business owner's standpoint. From what I can tell thus far with the going back and forth, they seem to be favoring the manufacturing companies, given better tax rates to manufacturing types of businesses, not so much to service kind of businesses. And I think it's because, you know, they're trying to, again, keep companies from going overseas, keeping their money here in the States. And so I think it matters that they're trying to reduce taxes at the corporate level, you know, the way they are. Now,
So can I stop you there? So you're saying you definitely think it matters in terms of a big corporation that might have a manufacturing plant and trying to decide, are we going to be in the U.S. versus possibly going abroad? You're saying something there like the corporate income tax being 20 instead of 35. That's a pretty big variable.
I think that's a big variable, yes. And so from that standpoint, I would see that they, those that have companies like that, here I'm talking about companies that deal with cost of goods sold and that sort of thing, I think it makes a big difference. Now, it doesn't work the same way for service business like CPAs, lawyers, you know, financial services professionals. You know, it's different for them. There doesn't seem to be as much of a tax break there from what I see thus far, okay? Now, to give you an example, with the pass-through business income, which a lot of service industries have in particular, the House is wanting to lower the rate, you know, from its present place right now, which is at 39.6%, down to 25%. Well, that sounds that's a great cut, all right. And at the same time, it wants to create still a lower rate of 9% on the first 75,000 of net business income that comes in if you're just an individual filer, or if you're a joint filer, it's up to 150,000. And so they're actually providing some benefit there. And these are companies that are LLCs in particular, and it sounds good on the surface. Now, again, it's not law yet, but this is kind of how the House is leaning. Now, the Senate is what they're trying to do with pass-through business income is just come up with a flat 17.4% deduction, you know, for this pass-through income. And that means that right now, LLCs and service types of business, they would be paying taxes the same way they're paying now, but then they would apply this 17.4% deduction on that, and that's what they would wind up paying. But this particular change would sunset in 2020. 26. So it has a limit to it. So this is how they're dealing with the pass-through income that a lot of service businesses have, a lot of LC corporations. Bob, you would probably fall into that category as well. Again, it's not law yet, but this is what they're batting back and forth. Now, I'm a C Corp. So from a C Corp, right now, you pay 35% on your corporation for any profits you have over $50,000. So I'm always motivated to make sure I clear out my corporation, you know, so I don't have to pay that 35% tax. And so I wind up taking it in as much income, salary, as I possibly can. But then I have to pay personal income tax on that. And of course, I have to pay it at whatever rate I fall into there. But what the House is now going to try to give me is reduce that 35% rate down to 20%. Well, again, that's pretty significant. Will it make a difference to me? Yes and no, because I'm a very closely held corporation. I'm able to watch my profits very carefully. But you take a company that's manufacturing, it's a manufacturing concern, this would make a big difference, big difference to have it reduced down that low. The Senate, on the other hand, they agree with the 20% down from 35 for C Corps, but they don't want to start that until 2019. Now, if you ask yourself, why is the Senate wanting to start later on some of these things? Well, I think the only way I can calculate it in my own head is that you know they're trying to hold to that $1.4 trillion cost that they know on the front end that this is going to cost $1.4 trillion over the next decade, you know, in potential lost taxes by having to make these cuts. But the GOP is saying, but you watch, this is all going to get reinvested right back in the economy, and it will definitely offset that cost. So this is why we still see the variances that we see between the Senate and the House.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you that that's partly why they're with some of these things that they're making them kick in, you know, not right away, is that, yeah, they do have. I think the official limit is $1.5 trillion is where, I forget what the rules are, but there's some reason that, you know, in terms of tax bills, they have some kind of thing where the other side can't filibuster it as long as the change isn't above $1.5 trillion over 10 years. So, and they did the same tricks with Obamacare too, with, you know, doing things like putting in measures that wouldn't kick in until a few years into it. And, you know, they were trying to limit the tax hikes, or they were trying to limit the impact on the deficit. And so with all these things, it's, you know, both sides play this game of timing it so that they can have these projections come out. And also too, just the very fact of multiplying the thing by 10 years, that, you know, that's an arbitrary window. But when you hear stuff like, oh, it's a $1.5 trillion tax cut, that sounds like it's a big deal, but really what that, you know, it might be more accurate to say it's $150 billion tax cut, because most people are thinking in terms of annual. And so then you realize, oh, well, since the government takes in so much money, $150 billion a year is not, you know, is that big, even though that's a huge number in the absolute sense. Okay, well, thank you, Carlos. So is it right to say, it sounds like, if I can condense partly what you were saying there, that for something like a manufacturing operation where there's a lot of things, you know, they have tight profit margins perhaps, and there's just stuff that, hey, these are the costs of our material and da da da. And so for them, you know, something like a change in the rate applied to the net income they generate that they then distribute to shareholders, that can make a pretty big difference, you know, when the shareholders are seeing what's the rate of return on their investment. Whereas a professional who's, I mean, basically, yeah, they might be earning corporate income, even if it's like an S corp or something or an LLC, but really it's, they're selling their labor. That's just, they have very specialized labor skills that command a high price in the market. But, you know, it's not like they're building something and putting in, buying all these raw materials and combining them to make something. It's basically just applying their labor in very specialized outlets that, you know, their tax, it's somebody who's a lawyer who's making $200,000 a year. If their tax rate goes up somewhat, it's not like they're going to stop being a lawyer and go become a janitor. And so is there that element involved too?
I think that's exactly what I'm trying to say. But so they have a point in what they're doing and where they're really trying to put the emphasis on that lowering of the taxes. And, you know, I see the Democrats just kind of holding on for dear life here, you know, because the GOP's got the momentum here to push this thing through. And it is a complete overhaul of the tax code. You know, we've just been focusing right now on a couple of things, but while our time is about to run out, if I can just quickly run down the list of some of the things it covers.
Sure thing.
So, you know, not only are we talking about the income tax brackets, but you've already mentioned that they've got some things to say about the Obamacare individual mandate. And again, they disagree, House and Senate. They want to do something about medical expense deductions. You know, again, the House and the Senate disagree. Mortgage interest deduction. This is a big one. And there's a disagreement between what the House wants and what the Senate wants. But I think that's going to be a particular interest for business owners, for house owners and individuals that are so wrapped up in the real estate market right now, and what kind of changes they'll make there could affect the markets, you see. They're going to make some changes to the standard deduction that most individuals take. You know, when you prepare your income tax return, everybody gets a standard deduction and there's certain dollar amounts there. Well, they're going to go into those and change them around. The child tax credit, they're going to be changing that. Again, the House and the Senate do not agree on how it should be changed. So they've got to come together on that one. The estate tax, you know, that thing comes around almost every time, but they have different feelings, the House, on what should be done with the estate tax versus what the House wants done. I've already covered pass-through business income and corporate tax. The idea of taking business tax deductions immediately instead of writing them off over a period of years, that's going to be changed, and there's some differences there. If you adopt a child, you get a tax credit, and they're going to make some adjustments there. And again, the House and the Senate disagree on what it should be, but they are going to be, you know, going into that issue. So it really is a very thorough tax reform act. But I think that the gripe that the Democrats have is that it's going to affect the wealthy and not the middle class. I mean, that's, you know, I don't know. There's the argument there that it's the higher income, the wealthy, that actually pay the most of the tax, that they should benefit the most from it. But, you know, that's an argument that goes back and forth. The point is that nobody likes to pay taxes. And everybody does what they can to try to minimize their taxes. And when you get to some of these bigger companies and bigger businesses, you know, some of the maneuvers that they've come up with is just to move out of the country altogether. So part of what they're doing here is just trying to, you know, shift all that around and keep the money here in the country. And again, to try to see if they can boost the economy up.
Well, thanks, Carlos, for that fairly comprehensive summary of some of the major changes. I think just in the interest of time here, we're going to have to wrap things up. We may revisit this topic if more information comes to light, or perhaps once the reconciliation passes, maybe we'll chime in with an episode, you know, once they do reconcile some of these differences and send something to Trump, and we can give our listeners some feedback there. So I want to encourage everyone, if you like this kind of material but want to learn more, remember we have a financial publication that summarizes what's going on in the financial markets from the perspective of Austrian economics and Nelson Nash's infinite banking concept, namely the Laura Murphy Report. And so if you don't know what that is, go to lauramurphy.com and look at some of the free samples we've got there. That's LARA-Murphy.com. So thanks for joining us, everyone, and we will see you next time.
You've just finished another episode of The Laura Murphy Show. Be sure to share this podcast with your friends and colleagues to do your part in building the 10%.
The Laura Murphy Show is provided with the understanding that the staff and contributors of LauraMurphy.com are not herein engaged in rendering legal, accounting, tax, or investment advice. On such matters, please consult your own professional tax, legal, or financial advisor.